why did you want to be a referee in the first place?
You know what, if I can't play football at the biggest grounds, why not try and be a referee at the biggest ground?
And a public figure that gets a lot of criticism directed towards them.
Brutal.
You got a lot of death threats?
The pressure after that was so huge. I remember leaving the country, you know, you look back as a referee and you think, I wish I'd done it differently. You make split-second decisions. Some you get right and some you get wrong.
Nottingham Forest, you were hired.
There was such a hatred towards it. I was getting threats. It was completely directed. It was bullying. One pundit asked for us to be removed from my job, for him to think that I can be employed to influence the referees. I never spoke to the referees. The one that caused most of the controversy was the Everton match, where everybody believed, I made the tweet, I didn't. When that target attack happens, it's impossible to survive.
The media chased you out of the role.
That's what it looks like. Because it was such a backlash, I was getting attacked by the owner. The Zamalek president made a statement that I was gay.
I wanted to ask you about VAR in general.
We need to change the laws of the game because the VAR has the power. I never believe any referee's corrupt. Okay. Yes, there's incompetence.
Were you ever offered a bribe? Ex-Premier League referee Mark Clattenburg breaks his silence on the Nottingham Forest controversy, the problems with VAR, and some wild stories. This episode is sponsored by NordVPN. More about them later, but you can grab a discount right now in the description below. So Mark, you've had a very interesting 18 months or so, and there's a lot in there that I want to get into. First, I've always wanted to ask a referee this. Why did you want to be a referee in the first place? Basically, why on earth would anyone want to be a referee?
That's the world's biggest question, isn't it? I think everybody used to see probably referees as one of the worst industries, the worst jobs. I think everybody never wanted to be a referee. And I think my mentality was, when I was a young boy, I always wanted to play football.
Yeah.
And because of that, I probably realized when I was about 15, 16, other boys caught us up in development. So I was reasonably good from 11, 12, 13. I went for some trials, played against Millwall. And just other boys developed probably more. And, probably I lost my way a bit. And it was my school teacher, Mr. David Reach. He sports teacher in Cramlington High School. He said, look, Mark, he said, I've got a thing on the Duke of Edinburgh Awards that you can do the referee exam. And I said, there was a few of the other boys going to do it at Bedlington High School. So I thought, let's just do it. Even though I might not be a referee, at least I'll start to know the laws of the game.
Yeah.
So that was where it all started. And then I then decided, I'll referee me father's youth team, Wide Open Juniors, and enjoyed it. The parents weren't giving us a lot of jip, which certainly happened further on in my career, but it was something that I enjoyed, and then it just seemed to take off from that moment. So I made that probably bizarre decision at 16 that I was wanting to be a referee, which was crazy. But looking back at it, it wasn't a crazy decision.
Yeah.
But I probably wasn't going to make it as a footballer. So in my head, I thought, if I can't play football at the biggest grounds, why not try and be a referee at the biggest grounds?
So you thought at that stage that might be a career path? Because I know I grew up with loads of people that learned to referee, and it was instead of getting a job at a shop on a Saturday, they'd ref the kids' games and those sorts of things. But you thought at that stage, no, actually, this could be a career.
It was such a bizarre, a quick process for me, because when I passed my exam at 16, I was being an assistant referee in one of the Northern League, which was the best league in the Northeast for amateur football.
Okay.
So I was an assistant referee.
Like really quickly.
At 18 years old. And then from there, I was refereeing the semi, this used to be the first division, second division, then the Northern Lions. And I was refereeing in the Northern Lions. And that was my step to then take us up to referee in the Northern League. And it happened, if I look at my career path from 16 to 18, and then from 18 being an assistant referee on the Northern League to being promoted to being a referee in the Football League at 24, it's very, very quick. So in them years, I was setting myself goals, but thinking, wow, I actually could make it because the steps were so fast. I didn't have to wait 5-6 years. And sometimes you get disillusioned when you don't get promoted. I always had the goals, and quickly I moved to the next goal and to the next goal. So before I knew it, I was refereeing Football League, which was one league below the Premier League.
Yeah.
And it was just a bizarre path.
So during that time, you said those like 5-6 years, have you got another job, or are you just refereeing full time?
Yeah, that was the difficult balancing it up. And right. that's the problem with all referees that are not professional, is you have a job, you have a family, and you've got to try and fit up all of this around. And I was an electrician. I started off as an electrician. Everybody used to go crazy in the cabins. It like when we used to, you know, they have the breaks and lunch, because they would say, oh, the weekend's available. And weekend was time and a half till midday, and then double time. And I used to blow the double time and time and a half, because I knew I was going to referee.
Yeah. Okay.
So they were like, well, hold on, you're getting peanuts to referee, and you could get more being electrician. But I always had the desire that if I didn't do the refereeing, I couldn't progress. Yeah. So I had to take that quick decision. And then I was lucky enough that I left the being an electrician, and I went into the office as an estimator, then estimating manager. And then I had to make the decision at 24. The company didn't want us to leave.
Yeah.
But I had to make a decision, because I was the boss of some estimators, and I was never in the office. I was always refereeing. So it was an awkward situation. And then when I got into the Premier League, it became a professional job.
Is that the point at which it does become professional? Are there professional referees lower than that?
Yeah, no. Wait, they are now.
They are now, yeah.
Yeah, you can now in the Championship, there's some guys in the Football League that are professional.
Right.
But the main, when I was a referee at 25, so we're talking 23, 24 years ago, that was the professional, so it was a job. Mm. Yes, it wasn't a great paying job, but it was a job that was like a wow, that you're not going to work 9 to 5. You can train for an hour every day, and then you go to the game fully prepared the night before you do the game, and probably had a better work lifestyle balance. So you had more time for your family.
Yeah.
Taking your child to school was one of the big things where you couldn't do that. If you had to go to work at 8 o'clock till 5 o'clock, then train later on, and then sometimes have a half day because you had a game in the evening, and that's not really great preparation. That you're going to do a job, probably had stresses in your job, and then you're traveling and then refereeing a match in the Football League. So being a professional referee was a better life balance.
I'm just going to pause for a second, because I'm very proud to announce that this show has its first sponsor, and it's a good one. It's NordVPN. As the owner of a marketing agency that operates online, it's really important for me and my team to stay protected with whatever we're doing online. And that's why NordVPN is essential to the operation of my business. Now, if you're a massive football fan like me, you can't watch every game because of the ridiculous 3 p.m. blackout, but you can if you use NordVPN. You can change your virtual location to another country where that game is actually being played. You can also watch games when you're abroad. NordVPN is also the fastest VPN, so no buffering, lagging, slowing your internet down. To get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/Ben Heath. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on a 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the description below. Go ahead and check it out.
So you get into the Premier League, and at that point, you're basically a public figure now. And a public figure that gets a lot of criticism directed towards them. What was that like?
At first, it was easy, because I wasn't the most senior referee. That only came in time. So what you had was, when I was probably the weakest referee, and there was 24 of us. Mm. So I was probably protected that, yes, I was a young referee. Yes, I managed players differently to some other referees. However, the top referees were Graham Paul, Graham Barber, Rob Stein, all of these guys, Steve Bennett, Mike Riley, all of these were taking all the top matches. So I was just getting the nice matches. I was getting managed correctly. So I didn't have that issue. Plus, we didn't have the social media aspect.
Okay.
So the only thing that we used to get, which was like a judgment if your performance, was the newspaper. Mm. And the newspaper used to give you a mark. And it was funny, because I used to love... I hated a 7.
Okay.
I didn't mind an 8, but I hated a 7. I didn't mind a 6.
Okay.
And bizarrely, because I used to turn the paper upside down so I could get a 9. So I didn't want a 7. So I was happy with a 6, an 8, and a 9.
Yeah. Okay. But as you become one of the senior refs,
that's when the pressure begins. Yeah.
That must
You get
suck.
Jealousy. There's jealousy in the group.
Okay.
You get a lot of, you know, there's a lot of infighting, because you're getting most of the games. Some of the referees didn't want the big games.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You know, some of them shied away from that because they knew the bigger games brought the bigger publicity. Mm. Where probably I had the skill sets over a period of time that probably very early on in my Premier League career, I was refereeing the biggest game. I think first year, I remember refereeing Crystal Palace against, Charlton Crystal Palace, which means if Crystal Palace lost, they got relegated.
Right.
So that was a huge game in your very first year that you one mistake could have took Crystal Palace down.
Yeah.
They eventually went down, but it wasn't my fault. So them pressures are huge. So I've always had them pressures. So when I got the big games, the big derbies, I made some mistakes, of course, a human being. But at least I gained them experiences. So when I got to the latter stages of my career, I would probably take most of the big games because it was important that the senior referees took the big games. So we always found that if the big games went well, especially the Saturday afternoon one, the early kickoff, if that went well, the whole weekend went well. But if it felt that if the first game went badly, it had a knock-on effect all weekend and it was just seemed to be a negative. Probably bizarrely, but that's where we felt. So it was important that we got the weekend off to a good start. And that's when the senior referees had to take ownership that we had to perform, because if we didn't perform, the younger referees would be under pressure.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you're saying, I was thinking you do often hear pundits saying it's been a terrible weekend for referees. Sometimes they'll highlight individual matches, but they'll often put it all together as bad decisions. So I can see that. You refereed into the social media era. That must have changed things big time.
Brutal.
Yeah.
It was brutal. You got a lot of death threats.
Death threats.
You got a lot of abuse. People say you can't read it. Don't read it. But you end up doing it. It's a subconscious thing.
Isn't you can't help yourself?
Yeah, I think everybody does. I think everybody searches for praise.
Right.
But the problem in refereeing, you don't get praise. There's not many jobs you do get praise. Doctors, nurses, police, fire brigade, ambulance, everything to do with saving people's lives should get the praise, but they get abuse. And everybody gets abuse. And a lot of keyboard warriors, the social media, I believe, is a massive tool. But anybody how that can have 6 and 7 accounts cannot be, it shouldn't be allowed. It should be, when I was in China, for example, you had to have your ID to open up a social media account. So your ID is linked to that account. So you're, accountable for that, for what you say. But in England, they can open up numerous accounts, and the abuse that you can take on these accounts, and the faceless, the police get involved, they go and search. And I remember one of our fellow referees, Mark Halsey, the abuse he took because he'd had cancer, and the abuse that he took on a message, and it was a young 15-year-old, I think, that was making the threats. And what do? You're balancing up to ruin a 15-year-old person's life, or you accept that, to give him a telling off. But it's not correct. And, you do your job to the best of your ability, but unfortunately, people don't always agree.
You said death threats. Were there any times where you actually feared for your life?
I think the hardest part was, when you made a big mistake in a big game, you always had that. I had episodes in my career, and there was different parts of my career. I remember I had a bad match, Everton-Liverpool, which was an important game for Merseyside, of course. And I made some mistakes in that game. And that had a knock-on effect. That went on for probably a year, 2 years. I would get people calling me house on a Saturday night.
Wow.
Giving us abuse. In the end, the only way I could get rid of them was to get a whistle. And I used to just blow the whistle as hard as I could down the phone. Because we used to have public phones then, so it wasn't like as much mobiles.
They could find it.
They found my home number. So they would constantly ring it during the night. So eventually it stopped when I kept blowing the whistle, because it must have hurt the eardrums. But that was just one level. And then you never really got a huge level of abuse to your face.
Okay.
Yeah, you got sporadic moments where people had too much to drink and it might overflow slightly.
Yeah.
But all of it was directed behind. It affects your children.
Of course.
It affects your family, and they read it and they're subject to it, because even my daughter now, she's 12, she Googles everything. She'll have a look on Twitter and probably search my name, and people don't see that the consequence that has. And all you're trying to do is doing your job to your best of your ability. It doesn't matter if you're a referee or any other job, you shouldn't be subject to that abuse. And unfortunately, everybody says, oh yeah, but refereeing, you know, it brings that abuse. But it's probably a culture that we just want to berate the referee in such a way. Yeah, if the referee's wrong, we can all have an opinion, the decision's wrong or why it was wrong. But when it becomes personal and what they want to do to your family, what they want to do to your wife, what they want to do to your daughter, that's when the line should get drawn.
Absolutely. That's crazy. Did you have to be careful of certain situations? Like, for example, you mentioned after Merseyside Derby, are you thinking, I can't go into a pub in Liverpool for a while? It wouldn't be safe.
I didn't think I ever went into a pub in Liverpool. The pressure after that was so huge. I remember leaving the country. It was just, I knew I wasn't refereeing the following week. I was right not to referee the next week because, you know, it was a poor performance because I'd missed a penalty at the end. There was some things in the game that we're going to argue. Yeah, there should have been a red card. I didn't see it correctly. But the penalty at the end was the one that if I'd seen it and awarded it, surely the VAR would have, in today's society, would have called us across. And it would have probably solved everything. Everton 2, Liverpool 2. It would have probably balanced it out a bit. But because everything seemed to go to Liverpool at Goodison, it would have been a very difficult situation to go around Liverpool because it took, I think, 7 years for me to referee another Everton match.
Really?
And then after that, I probably refereed them quite a bit in some big matches. But it was, nobody will ever forget that one situation or two situations in that game. And, you know, it doesn't matter how many good decisions I've made for Everton since.
Yeah.
Everybody will always remember the one that, you know, really affected. And, you know, I'm not stupid. I'm a football fan and I'm a Newcastle fan. And when we play Sunderland, I'm the same. And, you know, Liverpool, Everton, such a big game. And, you know, Everton fans will be furious that that was another one for Liverpool, you know. And, you know, you look back as a referee and you think, I wish I'd done it differently. I wish I'd saw it. I wish I had VAR. We can all make excuses. But at the end of the day, you make split-second decisions. Some you get right and some you get wrong.
I'll get back to the podcast in a second. Before I do, I just want to very quickly ask a big favor, and that's to subscribe or follow on whatever audio platform you're listening to this on, and please leave a review. The more reviews we get and the better our rating is, the more people will find about this podcast, which helps us get bigger and better and more interesting guests and further grows the community. You'd really help us out if you could take a few seconds just to do that. Let's get back to the show. Why did you keep being a referee given all of this?
Because of the love, and also it was a job.
Right.
You also had this, and the love of it was huge.
Okay.
You know, because I had the chance to go abroad, and going abroad and refereeing in Champions League, Europa League, international matches, tournaments, my very first tournament in Colombia, you see some amazing places, but also the respect's differently. So when I used to go to Spain, the respect was huge. Oh, it's Mr. Clattenburg. I was like a different person when I came back to England because I'd refereed the big sides 5, 10, 6, 7, 8 times a season.
Right.
I probably would only referee the big sides in Europe one time per season, and if everything went normal, oh, he's a good referee.
Yeah,
but in England, you were never a good referee. And there was that great side of the nice side of, you know, being, you know, traveling, doing the great things, and, you know, people go on and say, you know, about refereeing and it's all bad, but there is some amazing experiences that go along the way. So, you know, me not wanting to be a referee was, you know, times when, you know, the abuse becomes so much and mentally it becomes tough and it affects your family, my mood swings and everything else. So that's the balance certainly outweighed the negatives.
Okay. There must be some referees that's not true for. You must have known refs that just go, I can't deal with this anymore. I'm done.
Yeah, there's referees quit.
Yeah.
You know, there's referees quit along the way that, you know, there was certainly grassroots level. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And that's why the numbers, 28,000 referees were recruited in England. I don't know what the number is now, but it seems to be less and less because all Sunday morning, junior football can't seem to find referees. And, you know, that's a huge problem because you won't get the recruitment to the top.
Yeah.
And I think what we used to do, what we had a thing as a referee was we had to be role models as well because what used to be seen on a Saturday on Match of the Day used to go down the pyramid all the way down to grassroots level. Mm. They would then copy what used to happen on a Sunday morning. So you did have some responsibilities, but you also had a balance between the product and what the Premier League wanted, because the Premier League is the fastest league in the world. They didn't want to spoil the brand. The referees had to, you know, let the game flow a little bit more. Yeah. I used to have the referees slightly different between the Premier League, UEFA and FIFA, because they all had different ways
of
managing football matches. Yeah. Even though the laws of the game are the same, the interpretation of the law is slightly different.
Okay. If a child of yours or someone you're close to wanted to become a referee, let's say they're starting on that journey, would you advise them against it? Would you say go for it?
I think if the protection is right, and I think the FA is starting to move towards better protection, where referees can come through a system in probably a more controlled way. We have now under 11s, under 12s, under 13s in the clubs themselves, and they're good matches because the children are more disciplined, because a child who's worked under the professional football club will not want to be sent off because probably he'll be removed from the academy. So there's more controlled environment for the referees to come through, where I think coming through the system I did, for example, I went to send a player off and he was going to break my legs. Nice. And when I did eventually send him off, he threatened to break my legs. Wow. And for that 10 minutes afterwards, till I finished the game, I'm in complete fear of my safety.
Yeah.
And referees are subject to that. We've seen numerous articles, publications about referees being assaulted, and it's the same, and it doesn't matter, it happened to me, it'll happen to any other referee, because here there's a lack of respect, and probably there's a lack of, you know, now that we're talking about referees having to wear body cams so the police can charge, and it's getting to a huge point where does a referee want to be subject to that?
Yeah.
Or does he want to be subject because he wants to reach the top and be a Premier League referee with the goals of being officiating in one of the best leagues in the world? He has a chance to referee huge games in Europe, which I did. And you go abroad to referee. I refereed two matches in the MCG in Melbourne, 100,000 people. And when you stand there, you go, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you pinch yourself. So
there's
that side of it, but there's also the difficult side of it.
Were there any fixtures that you particularly didn't like getting? You'd come through and be like, oh, not that one.
It was strange because there's times in your career where I never disliked going anywhere because it was my job. One of the most difficult places to go was Norwich.
Right.
And Norwich was difficult for anybody from the northeast of England because the drive was brutal.
Okay.
You get to a point where you feel like you're only 70 miles from Norwich, but you end up 2.5 hours because it's a single road. And if you get caught behind a tractor or a lorry, it can take you a long time. So you get there and you think, you feel like, wow, I've got here. Probably the easiest would be get a KLM flight from Newcastle to Amsterdam, Amsterdam to Norwich. Yeah. But it was just, I didn't dislike the players. It was just, I didn't like the drive, especially on a night match.
Yeah.
Because it was difficult concentrating. People used to say, do you want to stay over? And then I couldn't sleep after a match. So I wanted to travel so far back. So the drive the next morning was a bit easier.
Yeah.
And then I had certain issues with clubs, not bad situations, but there was times where we used to have a running joke with the club secretary at Wigan, because every time I refereed Wigan, they kept losing. And I was like, and then eventually he sent us an email and it's, Clattenburg 8, Wigan 0. Then it would be Clattenburg 9, Wigan 0. And it was just a laugh, but it was like, mamma mia. And then I think it got to 12 or 13. Okay. Stuart Hayton, the secretary, will probably tell you this time. It must have been 12 or 13, probably it might be more. And then it finally won. So I sent him an email back saying, Wigan 13, Clattenburg 1. It was just, you know what I mean? It was like one of them moments where they finally won.
Yeah,
but they thought I was probably the bad luck. And then I've got this issue with Crystal Palace, where refereeing Crystal Palace, the one in the playoffs against Brighton 4-1. So there wasn't an issue. It just seemed to be that every time I refereed them, yeah, there were some decisions in the game that I probably could have made better, but I'd refereed them quite a bit and they never seemed to win.
Right.
And I remember one game, it was early January, and they were playing Aston Villa, who were bottom. And I'm thinking, wow, this could be the moment, you know what I mean, where they probably finally win.
And I'm guessing you're wanting that just in case someone puts it together, you're still make an issue of it.
It eases the pressure, but you're still refereeing the game and you're still, I want everything right, because that's the only thing that in your mind that you want to walk off 100% correct.
Yeah.
And I remember the goalkeeper threw one in and they got beat. I think it was Wayne Hennessy. I can't remember the goalkeeper, and he threw, like, you feel like you threw it in, and they got beat 1-0. And I'm thinking, how can this be?
Yeah.
Aston Villa beating Crystal Palace at the end of the game. I'm thinking, it doesn't matter what I do. And it just kept going and going and going. And then they got beat in the cup final and they were looking, you know, I could have played an advantage, should have played an advantage, but I sent off Smalling later on. They were 1-1. They get beat. They look looking for excuses.
Yeah.
Fans always look for excuses. And in the end, you know, it seemed to be that. And it doesn't matter when I referee Crystal Palace, they could never win.
Which were the worst players to referee? Who comes to mind?
Well, there was one in particular used to always cause me problems. That was Craig Bellamy. And it was my downfall, where I was refereeing him at Bolton and Bolton Man City. And I was lucky enough for a while, because he was always a player that was always on the referee's radar. It used to be where when we used to draw up lists of who was the most difficult players, he was always leading.
And you'd make lists like that.
We're not lists, referees, but we would talk about them. Yeah, because what we're trying to find is, we're doing our research as well as they're doing their research, because all we want is to be able to manage players. We don't want a red card.
Yeah,
okay. We're trying to manage players. And we had this discussion that Craig Bellamy's the difficult player. I was lucky because he was playing for Newcastle and I couldn't referee him. But then when he moved, then I was subject to him and how difficult he was. And probably it was our fault, or probably my fault. You're trying to manage these players more, and it might be easier, would probably be easier just to leave them alone.
Okay.
But we're trying to manage them because we don't want to get in any conflict. Probably that makes it worse.
Yeah.
And I had a situation, I incorrectly sent them off for 2 yellows. When I look back, it was incorrect. At the time, you think it's correct.
Yeah.
But when I watched it back, I thought, mate, the second yellow was harsh, probably wrong. And He never let us forget it. So it was, okay. He was one of the most difficult.
Are you surprised he's involved in coaching now, given his personality on the pitch?
No, because sometimes that can be good for the players. You know, he's a winner, and he's a footballer that plays with his heart on his sleeve. He's a winner. He's a great footballer. It was just, he was a very, very difficult player to manage as a referee, and that's something that we always tried to strive. It wasn't just about the laws of game. If we could manage the 22 players on the pitch in a very good way, in a balanced way, then that was a good, you know, good way of measuring it, what's a good referee and what's a bad referee. Because if you're sending players off for dissent, that's a weakness. You want to be able to manage these players and actually have 22 handshakes and get respect off the players. And if you don't get that respect, you know, it's difficult at the end of the game.
When you're refereeing a big game, do you have the sense of the occasion, like a big Champions League game, for example? Are you there thinking, wow, I'm part of this? Or does that not really come into it because you're just focused on the job at hand?
Of course it does. Okay. I remember the Champions League final, walking out in Milan, and all you're concentrating on, you know there's billions of people watching it. You know there's the cameras are on. And all I'm thinking about, don't drop that ball off the plinth.
Okay.
And that is what's bizarre in your head.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
in
yeah.
your head. You're thinking, I don't want to be on a video, a Christmas video, for dropping the ball off the plinth.
Become a meme.
And I know it sounds bizarre, but that's some things that are going on in your head.
I
remember the captains, both captains for Real Madrid and Atletico, screaming at us before the kickoff, you know, because we're in the tunnel and all want to get out. And the singers and the pre-match entertainment's going on longer than it should have. And the players were getting a little bit irate. And they said to me, Mark, tell them to hurry up. And I'm like, how am I going to tell them to stop singing? You know, it was like a bizarre moment. And because the tension started to build, you know. But you're walking out and you know the sense of, I think them games, you know that you'll always be remembered. I think in the Premier League, if you made a mistake, you can slightly recover. But it seems that when it's a final, there's no recovery. Because if you affect the result, then you'll always be remembered for affecting the result.
Of course.
And that's the most... I can't remember any of the finals, and I've refereed some finals.
Really?
I can't remember many because you start the game and you think, all I care about is finishing.
Right.
And finishing to a good conclusion.
You
where,
don't want howlers.
Yeah. And for example, the Champions League final, it finished on penalties.
Mm.
And that's probably a great scenario for a referee to be in, because there's always going to be a hero and there's always going to be a villain. The right. villain's the one that misses the penalty. The hero is probably the one that scores the last penalty or the goalkeeper.
Yeah.
So it takes the pressure away from the referee.
Do you ever remember a time where you got affected by the crowd chanting, really getting on your back?
No, I remember certain chants. It's like, because it's near the end of your career when you became, you know, more high profile, you refereed most weeks. And I remember the time I was refereeing West Brom. It was my last, and it wasn't my last game. It was the game that I came back after signing for China, for Saudi Arabia,
right.
2017. And the chant was, you can't, wait, can I say it?
Yeah, go for
right,
it.
Yeah, but it was like, you can't sell your arse to the Arabs or something like that. That's what the chant went up. And I was like, you know, it was like bizarre that I've just signed for Saudi Arabia and yeah. they were chanting that, you know. And so you can hear certain things, but
okay.
you try to block out.
Yeah.
As much as you could, you know. And I remember that game, what was bizarre, I made three massive calls against West Brom and the abuse I was taking outside. And then bizarrely, I was fourth official the following week at West Brom. Not one of them spoke because they watched it back on Match of the Day and all three were right. It was like, and then I remember Tony Pulis coming in and sitting, Mark, I apologise. I said, well, what he said last week, I went for you.
Yeah.
He says, but when I watched it back, I says, that's the beauty of football, isn't it? You know, the passion. But when they've watched it back, they see it differently, of course.
Well, that's good. Not everyone would do that, I can't imagine. Say, sorry, I got that one wrong. Do Premier League referees get paid well? There's so much money in football.
Paid more now, I think.
Do you know what they're paid now?
No, I don't really. I don't even speak to many of them now. So I don't. Right. They've definitely had pay increases. I think a lot of it, which is good, a lot of it's some of the payment is bonus related, so
okay.
based on performance, which is important.
Right.
And that means the senior referees normally are the ones that should get the bigger pay packet, because they're the ones that are taking all the risks, the bigger games. And what you couldn't have is a referee refereeing the same number of games as me and not refereeing the big games, because then it doesn't seem to be fair. So they did try to balance it out. When I was a referee, it was on par with the doctor, surgeons, and you know what? To be part of, you know, to earn that type of money was incredible. Compared to football, it was on the low scale.
Yeah.
But compared to the working class person, and I think referees would see that as well, that they were very privileged because they came from working class backgrounds,
right,
to be involved in football and to receive a salary that was compared to people who are saving lives. I think most referees respected that.
I guess they have to be paid well, as given what we've discussed around the abuse you get. And if it was a low salary, a lot of people would throw in the towel.
Yeah, we say that. Yeah, it would be some, but there's a lot of referees love it.
Mm.
You know, there's a lot. Certainly the sea, you know, would I say that, you know, I listened to some referees and I think the referee that's refereeing the Europa League final tonight, you know, the buzz that it gives him when he goes out on the field. And I think that speaks for a lot of referees, that you do get a buzz. The issue when you do get a buzz.
It's a live performance, isn't it?
It is, but it's also got a balance with tiredness. And when what you've got in the Premier League is you end up every week you're refereeing in the Premier League. Then you've got the peaks of you going abroad. Mm. And I remember going into Russia on a Thursday, coming back and refereeing a match on a Saturday.
Yeah, exhausted.
And I'll never forget, I felt so tired.
Yeah.
You know, I had to get down to Crystal Palace from Newcastle on a Friday, refereed the game on a Saturday, and I can't remember much of the game. Probably Crystal Palace fans still think I was rubbish. But it just felt that I'd, it wasn't that buzz. It's sometimes another game. But when you do have 1 or 2 weeks out, you want to get back out because you want that buzz again.
Is there a particular decision that plays in your mind that you know you got wrong looking back at it that haunts you a little?
Yeah, the Jimmy Carragher one, the two, Everton Liverpool.
Right.
Jimmy Carragher pulls Julian Lescott down, and I don't even know why the response was at the end of the game. I think, why am I getting this much abuse?
Had you just not seen it?
I played there was a video that the player ran across my vision. I'm thinking, well, what happened? It happened in a split second, and I just didn't catch it. And it's one that, if I'd got right, it would have put the balance back in the game, because everything seemed to be. I sent off two Everton players. I should have sent off a Liverpool player, but I took some advice from an assistant. I didn't see it correctly. Didn't have VAR, and got in. When I look on hindsight, I look back and it was wrong. Mm. But the penalty is the one that, if it gets back to 2-2, it would have given some balance back to the match, and the abuse would have been less.
Okay. Changing gears slightly, Nottingham Forest. You were hired, I want to get the exact wording, as a referee analyst. That's, I believe.
That wasn't true.
Okay.
So I wasn't employed as a referee analyst. That was Sky Sports
reporting
it. It was, you know.
So what was your role there?
So I was an advisor to the board. So
right.
I was advising in different areas. It wasn't just refereeing, and it was different other aspects. Because I've been involved in football quite a long time, I've seen a lot of things. I've understand the English culture. The owner, if not in a forest, is Greek. Mm. A lot of the people around him are Greek. So therefore, I can sometimes give him the English understanding of what's expected. So
yeah,
he trusts me. I've had a relationship with him because I was the head of refereeing in Greece. We had a mutual respect for each other. I left Greece and he still had that mutual respect. And he asked us to certainly help him understand some of the refereeing decisions that Nottingham Forest have received this year, which I couldn't give him any explanation for it, because a lot of the decisions were, you know, wrong. They were affecting the club, they were affecting the points. And certainly when a club is fighting for relegation and when you're a referee, you don't really understand the pressure. But when you're involved in a club, you realise the pressure of staying in the Premier League is so big.
Yeah.
Every decision scrutinised, and it got to a point where there was games after games, another mistake, the Pigeon were like, would accept that mistake. And then the one that caused most of the controversy was the Everton match, where, in my opinion, you know, there's at least from my experience as a top referee, was at least two penalties should have been given, even if the handball is questionable, and we can discuss if the handball is making his body bigger because of all these criteria. The third one is the one that if you haven't give two that are questionable, the third one is the one that has to be given and should have been given, and it wasn't. And that was a critical part of the game, and it was an important match for both clubs. And then you saw the pressures afterwards of clubs fighting for survival and not believing that they're getting the decisions that they should have been getting, that referees would have been giving them years and years ago. Because, you know, from my experience, you go, that's a penalty, that's a foul, that's a red card. And I don't always agree. I remember the first game I went to watch for Nottingham was West Ham, and I didn't agree with the Calvin Phillips red card. And I said this to the club, you know, they should have, Nottingham Forest should have had a penalty, but also Calvin Phillips shouldn't have been sent off. So for me, I'm trying to support the club and say, look, they've had a red card, you've won the game 2-0, the penalty wasn't so important. Yes, it is, but it wasn't so important because the other team went down to 10 men, incorrectly in my opinion. So I'm trying to give them a sense of balance as well, but also I've been in many meetings where I'm supporting the club on other aspects with the legal teams. I'm trying to give them my expertise, what I've understood about English football. So I wasn't just a referee analyst. I was actually a broader point. And one of my saddened things is that everybody seemed to... It was such a media scrutiny around the appointment, and nobody seemed to want the appointment. I think there was such a hatred towards it. I was getting threats. I was getting social media was so bad.
Threats by people on social media.
Yeah. And because some comments from certain individuals, and it was completely directed. It was bullying. One pundit asked for us to be removed from my job. My daughter's panicking when I go home because she's crying, thinking, if I lose my job, can she still go to school? Can she still do the normal things? So it does affect you that people can say such hurtful things when all I'm trying to do is a job for a football club. I haven't been a referee for 7 years. So because I was a referee, does that mean I always have to stay in the referee club? Am I allowed to leave?
Okay.
You know, because in refereeing, I've been left for 7 years. If the Pigeon Well or the Premier League wanted to employ us, they had the right. They could offer us a job, but they didn't. And it's my right that if a club wanted me to give them some advices in the right way, constructively, then I should have the right to do that. But it seems that the English media, people within the English game, certainly didn't want that. They didn't want myself or a similar role being connected with Premier League football clubs. But we all know Rugby Union had it. Sir Clive Woodward had it when we're successful in the World Cup. Clubs have it. Certainly in the US, they have it a lot. But it happens a lot in Europe. We've seen it that clubs employ certainly ex-referees to support them week in, week out in trying to have a sporting edge.
Mm.
It might be, you know, how to create something within the laws of the game. We saw that with Brentford, for example, early in the season, where two players were standing in an offside position from a goal kick, which you can't be. One player goes to jump for the ball, deliberately misses it, but he's challenging the player for the ball without a foul, and it leaves the ball clean through to the another player who can't be offside. So them little things are certainly things that referees think about, but players don't. So there is a sporting edge, but it just doesn't seem to be a fitting part for the English game yet.
Do you think Nottingham Forest and the owner thought that hiring you would put pressure on referees to perhaps change their decision-making or make sure they don't give a controversial decision against Nottingham Forest? Do you think that was part of the motivation?
Absolutely not. And I think every club in the Premier League has an ex-referee who looks after the referees. I wasn't doing that.
Okay.
I never spoke to the referees.
Right.
I've never spoke to them for 7 years. So how can I, or for him to think that I can be employed to influence the referees? I was advising himself and the club, for the club, if they had an grievance, for the coaching staff to have the right information. For example, the bounce ball at Liverpool. They didn't know the law, or they knew the law, but I could give them the exact and could advise the club on what's the best course of action when they do go to see the referee at the end of the game. Because what you don't want is the coach and staff to go in and don't know the law. So there is certain points. That's what I was employed to do. Never to influence the referees. I never went to speak to a referee. I never spoke to them afterwards. I never even wanted to do that. All I wanted was to support Nottingham Forest in anything that the owner and the board wanted me to support them on. And I didn't really, all I wanted was, you know, the referee to do a good job, because I was an ex-referee myself. And I sent Howard Webb a message that I saw a good referee, and I said, he's great. And he made a mistake in a game, but you could see the potential. So I could see certain good referees, and sometimes as a referee, you think, wow, that was a good performance. And the owner might think, or the board might think, but that wasn't really a good performance. And I'm like, it wasn't that bad, actually. So I could give them a sense back, you know.
So I believe you were the first person to have a role like that in the Premier League.
Yeah.
But do you think that's going to become more common? Will we see other clubs doing similar things?
I think it would be difficult. I think it's
because of the media backlash.
I think because of everything that went on, yeah. I think it was difficult. You know, there was a target attack, certainly from a TV company. That was clear. There was target attacks from some other organisations, and when that target attack happens, it's impossible to survive, because the media scrutiny. People say, you know, because I'm in the media all the time, that I love the media. Okay. I'm like, hold on, I've lost that. Did I ask for the TV cameras to be put on me when all I'm doing is watching the game and trying to analyse the game and trying to give Nottingham Forest a sporting edge by just seeing something in the play? For example, you know, we talked about the drop ball.
Yeah.
The advice I give after the drop ball was make sure you just hold the ball. Stand the ground where the ball should be dropped and just hold the ball. So the referee, when he looks around, eventually knows that the ball is what Nottingham Forest. Simple things, that's a sporting edge.
Yeah.
That's something that I should be able to advise on. But unfortunately, I think it's a negative and I don't think many clubs at the moment will look to do it because of the backlash it caused.
You mentioned company and a pundit being very critical. You may or may not have been referring to Gary Neville, because...
I wouldn't like to say who it for me, I don't like to say individuals. I think people can make that.
Fair enough. I certainly saw Gary Neville be very, very critical of the role, amongst others. It's interesting that you said around how much that affected you. Before you accepted the role, did you expect anything along those lines to come from it?
No.
You didn't think you'd get that criticism?
No, far from it. I was just I was a referee that had refereed in the Premier League, Saudi Arabia, China, managed the referees in Greece. I'd advised the board in Greece, the league, about professional refereeing. And I was offered a role. And I wanted to be a part of a football club.
Mm.
I think it's exciting. I think there is a role in the club. We have psychologists, we have dietitians, we have goalkeeper coaches, we have throwing coaches, we have, I think there was one team had a coach for the glasses to get the players ready for night matches, sleeping coaches. And we don't have a referee, an ex-referee that can support the team in trying to find a sporting edge when we have all these analysts
doing
trying
all
to find ways to score from a corner kick.
Yeah.
And I was looking forward to the role, but I realised very quickly, because of the negativity that was being created, that it was going to be a difficult situation. And it was right for me to part company with the club, because I didn't want to affect their future matches, especially when they were going into some critical matches. And I think every person in England saw the Everton Nottingham Forest game and can make their own judgments, you know, because it was such a backlash. Yeah. And, you know, it was better for me not to be the main focus, because everybody believed, I made the tweet, I didn't. That was nothing to do with me, that was the club.
Okay.
I just advised on the refereeing decisions. I believe that there was two penalties, not three, but three could have been given. I could understand if the first one was given, but the other two were clear for me. And that's what I advised, and that's what my job was. That's not influence refereeing. That's trying to support the club in trying to win football matches.
I imagine that the media backlash that you received and that Nottingham Forest received was made worse by tweets, statements released. You said that wasn't anything to do with you. Did you try and stop those public statements?
This is something between the club. I'm just an advisor.
Okay.
So
you haven't been consulted on
those. I'm down the chain of authority. So right. I can support in some things, but I certainly can't, you know, if the club want to make a statement, because that statement was made, and even if we agree or we don't agree with the statement, it was a build-up of refereeing incidents, because, you know, we can say that the Peachamwell are issuing another apology, again another wrong decision, again another wrong decision. If I look, for example, just at Nottingham Forest, other clubs will have the same grievances. There was a clear penalty missed against Newcastle, which had a material impact on the result, because it would have made it 3-2 to Nottingham Forest. They lose the match 3-2. The win against West Ham, which was fortunate. They go to Brighton. A red card should have been issued to a Brighton player. That had a material impact, because they could have come back and drew 1-1. The Liverpool bounce ball. Yes, people can argue, saying there was a minute and a half between, but the panic set in Nottingham Forest could have won a corner and scored from the corner. There's all of these little things. Then the situation at Everton, it seemed to be a lot of things. And it was earlier in the season, things, Bournemouth, Willie Bolly's red second yellow card, which was wrong. There's lots of other incidents which, yes, clubs get wrong decisions, but when you're in a good position in the league, they have less impact. Okay. But they seem to be, when you're in the relegation zone or you're fighting for the relegation, it seemed to have a material impact. And that statement was back of a lot of bad decisions that had happened during the season for Nottingham Forest.
Do you think there was anything behind those bad decisions? Was there any sense from other referees that they were perhaps annoyed at your involvement and your role? Or do you think it was just coincidence that you got
I would hope it's coincidence.
Okay.
As an ex-referee, I would hope it's coincidence, because referees should go in with a clear mind and clear focus that they don't want to make a mistake. And I think as a referee, I didn't want to make a mistake, and I don't believe that they do go to make mistakes. I think, yes, they make mistakes. Some mistakes are probably built up because of the VAR and the inconsistency with the VAR and the high level of intervention. I think every referee wants to get the decisions right, like I was. So I would hope that the referees thought like that. And I hope that my involvement, the short period I had in involvement, actually helped both parties. I helped the Pigeon Whirl, and also I helped Nottingham Forest in trying to build up relationship, which other clubs had, because of, you know, foreign owners, it becomes difficult to build them relationships, and that's the most important, to build up them relationships.
Did you ever get a sense from any either current referees or ex-referees perhaps that you were to some extent a sort of poacher turned gamekeeper? You'd gone to work for the other side, as it were, and criticism because of that.
But this is what we just talked about before, the referee club. What is the referee club? What is this, you know, am I not allowed? And I've done this for 5 years in the Daily Mail. I'm allowed, I don't criticise anybody individually. That's not my job. My job is to help and to get the people to understand why the decision was made, right or wrong. I praised refereeing decisions.
Okay.
I've also said that the decision's wrong, but I've never said that referee is bad, that referee shouldn't do this, that referee shouldn't be on the Premier League. I've never said that, and never will, because that's not my job. My job is to give the paying public an insight of what the decision should be as a former top referee. So if the referees, and we talk about now the manager of Pigeon Well, when he left the Premier League, he worked for BT. So he was on TV criticising refereeing decisions.
Yeah.
So we can't have it both ways, where an individual who is now head of refereeing, who was exactly the same, that we're just, all we're trying to do is educate, sometimes support when it's difficult, but we can't support, I certainly can't support, Howard Webb never used to support us on BT if the decision was clearly wrong, because we'll lose credibility.
Yep.
So we've got to be honest, and I hear Mike Dean, for example, on Sky Sports, criticising refereeing decisions. When you're out, I chose to leave the Premier League. I give them services. They paid me for my services. So that's where it ends. It's like any other job. Mm-hmm. And I don't owe Pigeon Well anything.
Okay.
If they wanted employers, then I have, under my contract, I would be duty bound to support them in the media, to do a lot of other things. But while I have no contract with Pigeon Well, I have a right with freedom of speech, certainly under the Daily Mail, to basically educate the people in refereeing decisions. And that's all I do.
How did you feel when that statement did go out questioning the integrity, or it seemed like it questioned the integrity of Stuart Atwell in this instance?
I think there was a lot of, to give background to that, I think it was widely publicised that, you know, there was a lot of, not unhappiness, there was a lot of uneasiness about the appointment, because on the Friday it was heavily publicised by media that Stuart Atwell was potentially a Luton Town fan.
Yeah.
And we always had this, certainly it was always when I was a referee, we wouldn't be involved certainly in a Sunderland match.
Yeah.
But we certainly wouldn't be involved in a club that were in and around, for example, Champions League.
Okay.
If Newcastle were in the relegation, which never happened, no, it did. But if Newcastle, for example, were down in the relegation, we wouldn't be involved in them, the clubs,
okay,
unless they were relegated, because it would just create
a story.
Yeah, and a pressure that would you don't need as a referee. Yeah. And, you know, all referees every year, they have to submit their you know, who they support. If, for example, their wife, a child, a season ticket holder. For example, I had to declare that my brother was a season ticket holder at Sunderland, and I had another brother that was a season ticket holder at Newcastle.
Mm.
So that was my declaration.
Yep.
I also declared that I was a Newcastle fan. And therefore, the PGMOL would always look, and they're duty bound, to protect their employee. I just believe that it was an oversight that, you know, that the management team at PGMOL had made that appointment. That was from my past experiences. As a fellow referee, I'm there to think, I'm not sure I would want to be put in that position, because you just know that there could be. You're in a no-win situation, because if the game goes well, you look at the social media and Luton Town fans will destroy him. If he does badly, then Nottingham Forest or Everton, whoever had lost, would have given the same treatment, and there was plenty of other VARs that could have supported that match and did a job that would have caused less. Even if the decisions were made, I think because they had this, and the media were, you know, what the media do to the club and, you know, to the people around the club, to put pressure, it's not nice for Stewart, certainly not, and it shouldn't have happened, but it could have been avoided. And it would have saved a lot of problems if that hadn't happened, from my experience. When I was a head of referee, and that's how I've got the experience, the same as Howard, when you appoint referees, and I appointed them in Greece, I had a referee from Larissa. And Lamia were the rivals,
right,
in Volos. And what I did, I couldn't appoint him to any... the playouts or the relegation playoffs, because the promotion, the top sides always had the foreign referees. So right. This referee never got matches for the last 10 rounds.
Okay.
And he came to us and he said, I understand. Because he knew he had a material impact. And when, I think it was the last match day, he had the chance to referee, and I gave him a match because it didn't have an impact. And he actually said to us he didn't want the match.
Okay.
Because he didn't want to have that problem in his life.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He's right. That,
yeah.
You know, and that's what always stuck in my head, this situation, how he came to me and he didn't want to be involved because he knew this area, region of Greece was difficult. So he didn't want to put himself in that position for what? 8 matches? And that's what, you know, I felt, and the discussions, you know, that were said, it would have been better if Stuart Atwell wasn't on the game, because it just put pressure on him, you know.
Even with him being involved in the game, do you think that Forrest should have put that out publicly, or should they have let their grievances be known privately?
That's a hindsight thing, isn't it? It's a difficult one to put in answer is, you know, there's a lot going on. You know, the club's trying to prepare for a huge match, and, you know, what we expect in England, I think we expect... There's a lot of different things in England that we'll accept. You know, there's countries that don't accept that. And there's trying to find that balance. What's accepted in one country isn't always accepted in the other. So it's trying to find that balance. And, you know, Stewart's a good referee and a good VAR. He's going to the Euro Championships, you know, just sometimes. And I had it. And I've refereed badly. I've just said I refereed Everton Liverpool badly. Some days you have bad games and some days you have good games. And it was one of them days where he didn't have a particularly good game.
Did that impact your decision to resign?
No, I just think it was a decision that was best for the football club. And it was a decision after discussing with the board that, for me, it was the right decision. I didn't want to be involved in something that had a negative impact. Refereeing decisions, it didn't matter that I was in the club because everybody thought I was the referee analyst, even though I wasn't. It felt that the decisions weren't getting any better. And I felt that myself after the Everton game. It didn't feel that I was adding any value on that side of it. And that was my main love, refereeing. And I felt that for the club to move forward, my decision not to be there was the best decision. And it was the best decision because they won the last two out of three.
That must feel quite frustrating. From what you've described, it almost sounds like the media chased you out of the role.
That's what it looks like. That's what it sometimes feels like. I felt when podcasts were being produced and they're making a joke of it. It was some targeted things where I was sitting because, I'm analysing the game like everybody else, and it was, talked about. They were told that I wasn't referee analyst, and they keep using the word referee analyst. So they were directing the media, the public, into thinking one thing. And I think it was difficult. Probably it'll be interesting to see if another referee who hasn't got the same profile as myself could do the role. It just felt, because we have, like I've said, there's ex-referees look after referees before the game and after the game, to bring in the food, to bring in anything they want, the juices. So there is ex-referees, but there isn't somebody of my experience and knowledge, and that's probably caused a lot of problems where, if, for example, I criticise the decision in the Daily Mail, which I'm employed to do, and I'm also an advisor and a consultant for Nottingham Forest, so I've got to advise them as well, I've got to say, and I've got a duty of care to the Daily Mail to give my honest opinion. And I give my honest opinion that if I believe the decision's wrong, I'll say it because I was an ex-referee.
Had Nottingham Forest been relegated, do you think the club would have tried to take legal action and tried to get games replayed or undone some of the bad decisions that they feel went against them?
I think it's always difficult to get matches replayed unless there's something completely wrong in law. We've just seen it recently in Belgium where a club overturned the decision because it was wrong in law. And we've saw a European under 17 women's match, again, having to be the penalty to be replayed because it was an last kick of the game. And it's quite a difficult situation. If it's wrong in law, then there is cases where the matches have been replayed.
Okay.
The issue we have is if the referee has made an error, which we're human being, everybody makes errors, including players and coaches, then it's part and parcel of the game. It's something that you've got to accept. And I think there's a lot of decisions that have gone against Nottingham Forest, but at the end of the day, the refereeing errors, and they'll look back, and hopefully next season the Pigeon Well will look to invest even more money in the education of referees and the VAR. It's been widely publicised over the last couple of weeks. Wolverhampton Wanderers, for example, wanting VAR removed.
Mm. What are your thoughts on that? I wanted to ask you about VAR in general, so it seems like a good time to ask.
I think it's where do we start? I was a big believer, really, really big believer of VAR. I thought, because I've made many wrong decisions, I thought, I wouldn't get as much abuse because you would actually get the right decision in the end. I remember going to Saudi Arabia and introducing VAR to Saudi Arabia in my second year.
So what year would this have been?
2018.
Okay.
So we introduced it.
Yeah.
So, it was a very difficult experience to actually get Saudi Arabia to implement the technology.
Okay.
However, I remember a situation, very first game, and ball over the line, and the goal was given in the semi-final of the King's Cup, and it was so widely praised. So they liked it because it solved the very first big issue. I felt it had so much potential, but we've also seen where football is different to other sports, because it's not factual. We've got a lot of decisions in football that are subjective.
Okay.
And because it's becoming subjective, it's creating some animosity. It's creating upset. People are anxious. There's a lot of things around this because it's not simple.
Yeah.
And I believe it's been complicated even more. I've always been the philosophy that a referee have all this education every 2 weeks. They go to St. George's Park or wherever they meet up and they go through a lot of training. The VARs go through the same training. VARs are referees. Referees are VARs. So they're the same human being going through the same training. However, they're given two different decisions. So if you clearly see a penalty and the referee can miss it on the field, 100%, yeah. It happens so fast. If everybody in the room, we used to all sit in the room before we had VAR and would go, that's a penalty.
Yeah.
That's a penalty. Oh, that's a red card.
Yeah.
And 99% of the time would all agree. Yeah, there'd be one really, there'll be a decision where it's really subjective and we're arguing. And for me, when we're arguing like that, it should just stay with the on-field decision. So we have got, so there's the three type of decisions. One where they've showed a good decision. The one where we've showed the referee's wrong and everybody goes, oh, that was most of the time. Or there was ones where we'd actually have an argument. And then Mike Riley, who was the boss at the time, or Keith Hackett, would stand up and say, no, this is the decision we want. So in the back of your mind, you're thinking, replaying all these decisions during the course of the game. So if you see a similar incident or a very, it's not all the same. We'll accept that the decisions aren't the same. Mm. But if we get a very similar decision, we should know the outcome. The problem is, the referee misses it. The VAR goes, I'm not sure. It's a clear and obvious error. Well, yeah. What's a clear and obvious to you, to me, and Joe Bloggs in the street are completely different. And then they've got this higher level of intervention because the Premier League don't want the match to be re-refereed and lots of reviews, which other countries are happy to have to get the right decision. We're now seeing more and more inconsistencies, not just wrong decisions. I'm talking about inconsistencies where 1 week a penalty is given because the on-field decision is given. The next week, the referee doesn't give it because he doesn't see it correctly. Mm. The VAR doesn't give it. And that's what's creating the bigger debate. And I think that's what's upset Wolverhampton Wanderers, for example.
Yeah.
We've also lost the joy, the excitement of a goal being scored. You know,
will it be disallowed? Won't it take some time? We've
lost the drama. Yeah, we've lost the drama. And, you know, we can argue, is it right to have an offside a millimeter off? Sorry, but it's factual.
Yeah.
You know, I believe VAR should be used for factual decisions and factual decisions only, and give the referee the power back to when we were referees. And referees then used to make split second decisions. And they can talk about accuracy and percentages. We never know if these percentages are right. All we're saying was, we go back 10 years ago, the game was talked about in a positive way.
Mm.
I think all we're talking about now is the negative VAR, and that's what's creating, I think, everybody's, you know, anxious about it, and, oh, we're going to get the decision today. You know, for me, I would love to see a referee go back and just referee decisions, and then the VAR goes, the ball was out of play, it was clearly out of play, there was a foul clearly outside, like we saw in the semi-final of a Champions League.
Yeah.
You know, that's a positive, but not to referee every game. And then what we've have saw in European matches, and I watched one game, it was Clermont from France. He refereed Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, and he awarded two penalties. He just bang awarded them.
Yeah.
And they were both correct, but he didn't need the VAR to go, is it clear? Do I give it? Do I interfere? Do I send him the screen? Bang, I give it. And all the players accepted it. I think when the referee doesn't give it and then it goes to VAR, the players start getting upset and they start getting anxious. So there's a lot of things that we can talk about and improvements. I just feel this year there's been more inconsistency because of this higher level of intervention. And I think the VARs are less likely to be involved. But it doesn't say that the decision's right or wrong. You know, I used to see reports on a weekly basis when I was working for Nottingham Forest, and we had decisions that the independent panel would say were clearly wrong. or, you know, there's five people, four of them would say it was clearly, the referee was clearly wrong not to award a penalty. But then we had the opposite side. They all agreed that it wasn't a VAR intervention. So as a fan, and there's people,
yeah,
I don't think people could understand that the decision was wrong. The majority of the decision was wrong, but the VAR shouldn't interfere. So people can argue,
there's a gap there, isn't there?
What's VAR? What is VAR for? VAR supposed to put the wrong decision right.
Yeah.
But it doesn't.
I imagine there were many scenarios where you're making a decision, let's say on a penalty, and you're like, I think it's 60%, you know, it's a 60-40 penalty. I think it's just about a penalty, that sort of thing. I get the sense that if there's VAR, a referee is going to be far more likely to go, it's 60-40, I'll let VAR pick it up if it is. Whereas pre-VAR, you have got to make a call on that.
Mm-hmm. And that goes back to when we used to make split-second decisions, and we also used to use experience. We're moving in position and had to be right because you had to see the decision. You don't have to now. You can get lazy because you can actually just think, like you've just said, we can rely on the VAR. And I don't want to put a blame culture, but what I don't want to see is referees pushing the blame onto the VAR unnecessarily, because I think a top referee, and there's some top referees in the Premier League, should be making these decisions like they used to.
Yeah.
And just, it's a penalty. And have that ability to make them calls and not have to rely on the VAR. I don't believe that, because there's a lack of referees also in the Premier League at the moment, and also VARs, that there can't be a punishment. It's very difficult to punish bad performances. When we made mistakes, we're punished.
Right,
we'd miss two or three matches.
That would be the consequence.
Yeah, you'd have to be fourth official, or you'd be taken out of the line. It's difficult for them now because there's a lack of match officials. So if a referee makes a mistake, then he's out the following week.
Okay.
And, you know, we saw that with Everton Luton, for example. The referee, Pigeon Well, accept that there was an error, but both of them were back out the following week. And that's something that would never happen when we were referees. We would have been taken out of the games, because when you make such a mistake, then, okay, if it's subjective. And also, if you make a mistake and, you know, it's an acceptable mistake, and a mistake that you can understand, because there is decisions in that grey zone where you can say,
yeah,
like the handball, for example, that is in the grey zone. For me, I think it's a penalty, but it's one that I can also not support the referee, but I can understand it. There's other decisions you don't understand because they're just so clear, you know.
I guess the same way that players can have, you know, really poor performances and they might be dropped for the team for a couple
of
weeks.
But you can have a striker that misses three goals.
Yeah.
And I get the argument, if he's a good referee, senior referee, he can make mistakes and he can be out. But it's the players, if they're in bad form or they're not refereeing well, or, you know, they're certainly going to be taken out of the team, or, you know, it was always referees, there's got to be some sort of punishment. I think the outside world accepted punishment and wanted punishment because, you know, you went into a game. I remember, for example, in the Champions League, and if you made one mistake in Champions League, you didn't get any more matches for that campaign.
Really?
So the pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember coming home every game, every time I'd been in Europe, and my wife would say, how was it? It went okay. And my mark was okay.
Yeah.
So I knew I would get another match.
Yeah.
But there's other time, I remember one game I got a 7.9, and that was it. Finished for that campaign. And it made you strive to make sure that you got everything right, because you couldn't afford to lose it.
So what would you do with VAR then? Would you go along with Wolves and get rid of it from the Premier League, or would you make some adjustments?
I think I don't believe in getting rid of it.
Okay.
I never believed that, because technology, certainly the one part of the technology which was before VAR was the goal line technology, which has been a massive step, but it's factual.
Yeah, yeah.
So when it's factual, it's accepted.
Okay.
So if we can keep it to just factual decisions, the ball goes over the goal line, there is a handball outside that the referee gives a penalty, there's a hand free kick given outside that should be inside.
Inside or outside the box?
We had a situation, I think it was Newcastle Luton, player held his shirt, carried on inside, referee gave a foul outside. you didn't have to go to the monitor because the VAR clearly said that's a penalty because the shirt was being pulled inside.
Yeah.
And he didn't have to go to the screen penalty. That's the perfect scenario, and just for me, an offside. And leave everything else to the referee and give the power back to the referee, which is what the laws of the game say. The referee has the power. At the moment, we need to change the laws of the game because the VAR has the power.
And interesting.
I believe that referees, and we've got some great, very, very good referees at the moment, that, you know, can make these split-second decisions. Do we need a referee, if we go to factual decisions, do we need a referee inside the VAR? Can we use an operator?
Yeah, okay.
Because they're so factual decisions.
Just looking at lines, effectively.
You're just looking at fact. You know, is it inside, it's outside? Or you can have one person in there, not two. I think it'll remove all the inconsistencies. And then what you've then got is the clubs know that Pigeon World say to the referees, this is a handball, and therefore would expect it given. If it isn't given, then you can understand why, because the referee might have a wrong angle, and we go back to the old school, and then we don't have this frustration every week. Why did the VAR not interfere? Why is the VAR not interfered? And that's what everybody talks about now.
Gary Lineker has been a big advocate recently for introducing like a challenge system where clubs get one or two challenges a game. What do you think of that?
I've always said that.
Okay.
I said that the very first time in some interviews. I thought it was a positive step forward. I know FIFA are trialing it at the moment.
Right.
And it would certainly take away the VAR because you wouldn't have that level. You wouldn't need to interfere because if you have the challenges, all that is going to happen is the coach puts a challenge, the referee goes to the screen and re-watches it.
Yeah.
So you're going to take it all out. Would it improve it? I think we'd still be having huge debates. Okay. I think what we've got at the moment is, and you know, and I know Howard's got a very difficult job. We've got some very young referees now, and they need experience. They need support. Mm-hmm. I know what it was like being a young referee in the Premier League, and you know the scrutiny. It's more now. They're making a lot of decisions in games. They're going to get some wrong. It's natural. It's now getting a program in place to get them to a level where everybody just gets to go, that's a foul, that's a penalty, that's a handball. And yeah, we might miss one, but that's part and parcel of the game. And I think the challenges would, the only thing I can think negatively about the challenge would be a tactic being used. You've got two challenges left. And it happens in tennis, where if you've just played a long rally and you're going to serve, and I've watched it a few times, they'll just put a challenge in deliberately to
catch your breath.
Because they know they've got to serve within, I think, I can't remember how many seconds, but they've got to serve within a time scale.
Yeah.
So they know by putting a challenge, because they've got plenty left, they're just delaying that chance of a serve, and it gives them the breath back. And I think what we could see in football is a very similar tactic of, if you're winning, you know it's not going to be given, but you throw it up.
Yeah.
And also that will change the by the time the referee's gone to see it, we've wasted 30 to 1 minute.
Yeah.
It can change the course of the game.
It break up the play or the pattern if a team's dominant or something along those lines. Because I believe the Swedish league has decided to get rid of VAR. I think they voted to get rid of it.
Yeah, they voted against.
Voted against introducing it.
Yeah. Okay. There's countries, I think France looked to remove and it didn't. Mm. And the problem you've got also is, there's a balance, because if you do remove it, it will have an impact on your European sides. And as we know, English teams have a huge, you know, I think we could end up having 6 or 7 teams this season in Europe, or certainly 6. And them 6 teams are going to be using VAR.
Mm.
I think what we've got to learn from a lesson is, if we look at UEFA's competitions, yes, they have the best VARs, but the European competition seems to have less debate and less discussion than we do that we're seeing in the Premier League. And you know, I think they've got to try and find a balance to what we see abroad and what the referees are doing week in, week out in the Champions League games, to what they can do to improve it in the Premier League.
So is that partly the media's responsibility then, to not make such a big drama over mistakes the referees make?
It's happened from, you know, media's a huge part of the game and they pay a lot of money to be a part of the Premier League. So there's always going to be that media scrutiny. There is some media outlets, you know, more critical of others. You know, some don't even know the law. When, for example, the Aston Villa goalkeeper got a second yellow in the penalty shootout, the commentators didn't even know the law. They thought the goalkeeper should have been sent off.
Right.
If you know the law, that certainly isn't the case. So there is certain areas where, you know, there is, you know, there's the media create debate.
Hmm.
People spend, you know, there is a part for the media to play. I think one of the things is that we've all got to understand that, yeah, refereeing's life's difficult. I was a referee and I made mistakes, but you've got to accept that when you make a mistake, it's going to have an impact. When I made a subjective decision, which I believed, you know what, that could be right, it could be wrong, I could accept it. You know, nobody wants to make a wrong decision, but there's always, you know, it's like a player missing an open goal to win the game. He's going to be gutted. And I think it's the same with the referee.
Okay. Change your tack a little bit. Not long ago, you were the president of the Egyptian Referees Committee. What exactly did that role entail? And how did you get it in the first place?
Yeah, so I was contacted. I just left Greece.
Yep.
So Greece and Egypt are very close. They saw the developments in Greece. Greece is a very difficult country to manage a group of referees because there's some big personalities as presidents. And also the federation can be very difficult. There's a lot of politics, which we don't always see in other countries. So a very similar, certainly similar thing was developing in Egypt. I was approached and I was asked to become the head of refereeing. But the problem was, it's like everything. Immediately I started, the chairman of the referees committee resigns, probably in protest. I don't know. I never met him.
Okay.
But all of a sudden your department becomes weaker. So then you end up being dragged into a lot of other aspects of the job, which you weren't employed to do. So one of the areas was I started to have to do the appointments, which is always politically difficult.
Right.
You also, there was a lot of relationships in Egypt, which I started to analyze very, very quickly. So the two big teams in Egypt was Zamalek and Al Ahly. I'd already saw decisions before I'd even arrived. I used to be sent decisions from a colleague who lives not far from us in the Northeast, who was a professor in the university. He used to send us a lot of clips from the Egyptian league and some of the things you wouldn't accept. You would be complaining in England even more.
Right.
And it seemed to be targeted. Some decisions were targeted against one team, some targeted. It was
really.
So it was my job to try and improve the referees. And one thing I did was I give them a lot of lectures. It's difficult when they're not professional to meet them every 2 weeks because they've all got jobs. So we used to do a lot of Zoom calls. I used to meet the referees after every match day. We used to discuss the incidents. We tried to give them uniformity. The VR got better. And I think in the short period of time, one of the areas we looked at was a referee in Egypt would whistle 50, 60 times a match for any small contact. That reduced to something like 32, 33 fouls. So the clubs, the media, the TV companies were given positive feedback because the game was flown a bit more. So that was one step we looked at. The next step was to try and get the referees and the VRs to be uniform. We got less controversies. But with that, one of the big sides weren't strong anymore, which created a huge media because, for example, I think I was getting attacked by the owner or the president of Zamalek because Zamalek weren't playing very well. He saw the arch enemy rising up the league. The referees were, in my opinion, if you made a mistake, you wouldn't get a match.
Mm.
That was to then make the referee better. But the problem I also have is I was also coaching and managing the referees in the second league and there's no video.
Okay.
So there was none of the matches were televised.
Right.
So it's difficult. I can go to a match, which I did, But it's difficult without any video to support and help the referees. You need all the video material.
Yeah.
And also the top league's different to the second league. So you can't use top league footage because it's completely different to the next league. So there was a lot of difficulties in Egypt, and also the financial crash of the dollar. And I was paid in dollars. There was a lot of things difficult. And then the Zamalek president made a statement that I was gay.
Yeah.
Which was quite offensive in Egypt.
Yeah.
And quite disrespectful. Especially when I've got a family. But he knew that word is quite offensive in Egypt.
He did it on purpose because he knew the reaction that would create.
Yeah, and there was a lot of other things. I hadn't had my salary. There was a lot of things. And it was also, I found it difficult to live in Egypt. Mm. Egyptian people are great people. But when you've lived in Spain or you've lived in Greece or you've lived in England, there's less restrictions.
Okay.
You know, for example, in Egypt, you can't drive. It's difficult to drive because they drive completely different to anywhere else in Europe.
Yeah.
So you can't go from A to B. You can't go to a shopping mall. I was living in a hotel and I found it difficult. So the right moment was to, especially with the salary I was on, I was unhappy. Also, they were finding it difficult because clearly my salary was late.
So yeah,
it was an easy decision, and both parties came to an agreement. And I think it was the best for both parties that, yeah, I was unhappy, and B, it relieved them of their financial obligations. So I think both parties were happy in the end that we parted way. And, you know, I wish Egypt people, I still get a lot of message from Egyptian referees, and, you know, a lot of referees felt that they were being treated fairly. That if you refereed well, you got matches. If you didn't referee well, you didn't get matches. But the problem in a lot of countries is you'd have referees that would referee. There would be, I think when I arrived, they had 80 referees refereeing 10 matches. So work that
right.
Permit.
Okay.
So if you work that permutation out, it's very difficult to give referees games.
Yeah,
so if you've got some good referees, like the FIFA referees, who are really good referees, they should be out most weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I need the exposure for FIFA.
Yeah.
But then you'll have guys coming and women and men coming to your office every day complaining that they weren't getting matches. And it was just mind-boggling that there was 80 referees, because it's all about status. They all want to be in the top league. But they're happy to have one or two matches a year, but that's no good for the competition.
No.
You need them refereeing regularly and getting experience.
Okay. That sounds like a crazy little stint that you had. In
it was
Egypt
a good stint, nice experience.
That must have been very bizarre when he came out and said that you were gay.
Yeah, it was because it was something that he knew he could, you know, people didn't believe it, didn't respect it.
Okay.
And he got criticized a lot for it.
Right, okay.
Because he realized that, you know, refereeing was fair, and I made it as fair as possible. I didn't care who wins, as long as the referee did a good job, the VAR did a good job. If there was a negative impact by the referee or the VAR, then it's my job to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And the only way sometimes you can do that, like I said, is to take them out of the limelight,
yeah,
to make them reevaluate that when the next come back in, they won't make the same mistakes.
Do you think there were corrupt referees before you got there, if he wasn't liking the fair results by the sounds of things?
No, I never, that's one thing I never believe. I never believe any referee's corrupt.
Okay.
Yes, there's incompetence.
Right.
There's some referees better than others. That's life. You know, I think in all walks of life, there is better people in your profession. There's some that need more training. Some need an arm around them. That's what I needed. You know, I sometimes needed a... Pierluigi Cleaner was very good with me. He got the best out of me because he knew how to manage us by putting his arm around us. He knew I needed to be loved, where other managers in the PGM world didn't give us that, didn't give us that feeling. So you react to different situations. Corruption, you know, you've seen corruption around the world. I think it's one of the biggest problems for FIFA and UEFA. Matches being fixed.
Because, yeah, we know sometimes clubs have been...
But sometimes you can take the referees out of that. You know,
okay.
It's not always the referee that can be involved in that. Sometimes the club arrange, sometimes, you know, players are involved, the coaches are involved. You know, we've seen in past referees being suspended for it. But it's sporadic. It's very, you know, very small number that's been brought out. I think in general, I think referees want the best. that do the best. But some, and certainly in some of the, like Egypt and Greece, they got paid a lot of money. They want that money, you know, to help their income, help their families.
Yeah.
And, you know, they want matches. And when they don't get matches, it affects their family. And that's when they get upset because they just want to referee matches.
Were you ever offered a bribe to make decisions a certain way? Or I suppose the other side of it would be threatened to make decisions for a certain time.
I was very lucky. I was very, very lucky. I was never approached, never.
Do you know of referees that were, though? Is that a story that you sometimes hear other referees tell?
No, that's one thing the referees wouldn't, because I would be duty bound to report them.
Yeah, okay.
Because that's something that isn't right and shouldn't be accepted in any way, shape, or form in football. So I was never approached. Because I was always refereeing the big matches abroad, the top teams. Yes, some teams used to give you some gifts at the end that were acceptable gifts, a shirt, a pen, a pennant, a bag, tracksuit. But in general, it was, you know, that was the level, because we got paid such a high salary. So the clubs thought, we can't even touch referees because they're getting paid so much money for a Champions League game. Then what wasn't necessary, we were judged, and also I was judged, what I've just said before, I need to perform to the best of my ability because I want another match.
Yeah, okay.
And another match. So, you know, yes, hear about it, but it was something that I was never exposed to, or even, I've never even heard anybody around my circles to be subject to that.
It's not when referees are chatting again, you'll never believe what, you know, such and such.
Especially English referees were never subjected to that. We were,
okay.
I think everybody around Europe accepted that English referees were, you know, even though would make mistakes, there was never any of that suspicion. Never any suspicion.
Okay. You've obviously refereed tons of games. Is there a favourite moment, something that sticks in the memory?
There was some special, I think one of the special, one of my special moments was probably the Olympic Games in London, 2012, and refereeing the final. I did two other matches, and to be nominated by FIFA, because it was a FIFA tournament, to referee the final, Brazil-Mexico, and in Wembley, was probably my first and probably one of the most enjoyable tournaments, but also to finish that tournament. And it was a great tournament to be involved in, because you could go and see other sports. You were part of London, which was so iconic, to have the Olympics in your own city, and to referee the men's football, the gold medal match, was just incredible. And I remember the game was a brilliant game. Mexico won 2-1. A lot of superstars were playing that we would see now, for example, Neymar. They were all playing in this match. Yeah. So there was some great players playing in this tournament. And I was a youngish referee, given that opportunity. And I remember, I think it was Sepp Blatter, I was in the lift as we're going after the match, going up to my hotel room, and he went, "Son, you did very, very well." And I was like, wow, the FIFA president said that, you know.
Yeah, so yeah.
It was, them moments probably live with you forever, especially the Olympic Games, because London put on a great, great show.
The future for you, obviously you're on the new version of the Gladiators. How did that come about?
It was brilliant. it was so bizarre. I was in Thailand on a golfing trip with the boys, and I got a phone call from an agent saying, you're one of some people that Hungry Bear, the production company, are looking at to be the referee on Gladiators. And I'm like, mamma mia, John Anderson, it's John Anderson. Yeah, then I looked up. I said, call me John Anderson, he's 90 something. So that ruled him out. And I was like, wow, I remember watching that as a child, loved it.
Yeah,
it was so iconic. It was so amazing. And we had the discussion, we had an interview, and they had some doubts because of my profile, that I might have been too, the role might have been, for my profile, might have dominated it a bit.
Right, okay.
And I get that. I get that argument. And I just wished them all the best. Never heard anything for a few weeks. And then they've invited us to some screenplays in London. And I did the screenplays for BBC and Hungry Bear. from that moment on. They were like, you're going to be the referee. And I never thought, when you're in rehearsals, because we did the rehearsals, the shows in May, June.
Okay.
And we did it. It was so fun. Absolutely brilliant. But half the time you're laughing because the gladiators are good fun. We had such a rapport.
I can imagine.
It was brilliant. It was backstage. We had the contenders were good. There was so much drama. We had some really good fun. And we left. And then there was this lull. And then all of a sudden, it was January was going to be the launch. And everybody's nervous about the launch. BBC and did a lot of work. And I never thought anything of it. And then I watched the first show and I thought, oh, we'd seen a show. We got called to London to watch one of the shows.
Right.
And I remember watching it going, wow, this is dynamite. So when the first live show came on BBC, I went, that's brilliant. And I didn't realize the reaction that it was causing. And everybody was talking about it. And there was a situation, my friend called us, I think it was the second episode, and he's a season ticket holder at Sunderland, and him and his son go to watch the matches. And another father and son were sitting next to him, and the score was very tight, and the father and son wanted to leave. He says, we're leaving. And Jason said to the guy, why are you leaving? The score's tight. It's like 2-1, whatever was. He said, No, he says, I've got to get back for Gladiators. And then you realized how many people, and to get the audience figures that they did in today's society, especially when a lot of people don't watch as much TV as we did years ago, because there's so much to do with socially, I think was incredible. And now we're going to film a second series. So everybody's excited again. The Gladiators are all, you know, probably in the gym now, muscling themselves up, ready for the second series. So I think, you know, I think a lot of people learn from the first series as well, including myself. I wasn't perfect, and you know, I might have to get rid of the Scottish accent that everybody's directing us at, even though I'm a Geordie. But there's other things that you know, it's sad because I took a lot of abuse from that as well. You know, and
all well, I'm you're trying used to that at this point, I suppose.
Yeah, of course, I'm used to it. But you know what, you're part of a game show, and people lost that. You know,
right.
In football, you're not a part of a game show.
Yeah.
This is a great, it's entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, I've got to be the baddie sometimes. I've got to be the goodie. You know, you've got to be a part of the show. So, you know, to be a part of that, and for children to talk about it the way they do, you're going in airports and the mothers and fathers are coming up and like, the Gladiator and Diamond, and what's this person like? And you're like, wow, my game. It's like, how big is it becoming? You know, hopefully people will enjoy the second series as, you know, from the first series. So, yeah, we're looking forward to it.
Fab. And is that your plans? I can't imagine you're going to want any referee analyst or other similar jobs that come up. Is it media work for you going forward?
Yeah, there's a lot of media work. So I've just finished off some game shows. I've just finished The Weakest Link.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't tell you much about that, but there'll be some embarrassing moments probably coming up. I've got The Wheel, which I'm doing filming next week. And then we've got, I'm working for Fox in the Euros as their analyst, which I've been doing for some past tournaments. Especially the Americans, they like the analysis, which I can give. I can give an insight of what it's like sometimes through a referee's eyes. Not just saying that the referee's wrong, right, or indifferent. It's trying to give them an understanding why they've made the decision. I've got a lot of that, Gladiators. And then I've got some Champions League referee analyst work as well on TV. So some really good things going forward. You know, my diary is always difficult to, you know, but I like to keep myself busy. And, you know, I've looked back at my career, and without refereeing, we go back to that simple question. Why did you want to be a referee? It's opened up a lot of great doors and a lot of great opportunities. And it's certainly, as I sit here, if I wasn't a referee, I wouldn't be talking to you now.
Yeah. Yeah. Fab. Well, Mark, thank you very much for taking the time to come and talk. As you say, you've got a very busy calendar. I think that's been really interesting. I think a lot of people will have been wondering about all the things that have been going on with you and Nottingham Forest. And I think you cleared a lot up there. So thank you for taking the time.
No problem. Cheers.